what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, right. 11,
and most of
11,
and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Boxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Boxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366. Or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody, welcome aboard Foxed Up here for a Thursday evening, or possibly Friday morning, or Friday afternoon like it is here, but you know what time it is where you are, and that was quite a horn section there. I dig when Mark rings, and we still got to get Guy involved in there, and you know, Joe will probably pop up again soon. It was good to see him in the chat room today. Howdy, Joe, if you're possibly listening, but I think you left the library a long time ago. And, geez, we got to make up for last night a little bit. So, last night's subject is tonight's subject. We're going to do the case for and against carbon trading today. There was this great series of articles over at Celsius.com. It's C-E-L-S-I-A-S.com. And all the links are up on today's show post again. And you can check them out yourself. And there's three really great pieces. For, against, and then there's an op-ed on whether or not carbon trading lets the worst polluters get away with environmental murder. But I do have to do a little tidying up from last night's show. For those of you that witnessed last night's show, it was, shall we say, we were taking out some trash. And I got some amazing emails from people, but I have to share with you my absolute favorite. and this will probably be my last word on the subject. And this is from a regular listener, a gentleman by the name of Nick, who listens to the show in Canada. I'm not sure if he's a professor or what, but he does work at the University of Manitoba. And he sent me this email, and this is the first thing that I saw this morning when I hopped online, checked my email. And it says, "Good afternoon, John. Yes, it's me, Nick, the guy who will call in one of these days. Oops, sorry, I giggled. I heard your Wednesday show as well as a piece of the horn section. I had to comment because I want to thank you for your honesty, your passion for all you do, and your willingness to tell it like it is. As a horn listener, I like the shows that are carried. I don't necessarily agree with everything everyone has to say, but I'm cool with that. I wouldn't want to agree with everyone else. That would be some sort of sick right-wingy land thing. Wipes barf off keyboard. I love the conversation. I love the debate. I love the humor. I'm Canadian. I spell with extra U's. So do I. That comes through on the shows. It's all great, and I think that, as Agnes said and the others have said, if you don't like it, turn it off. Keep up the good work and keep up the giggling. There just ain't enough of that on regular radio. Those who are of similar ilk to Jim will have to live with the gigglers, honest people. Those who aren't having private hands-in-the-pants sessions with pictures of Eva Braun or whatever they do. Now I'm babbling. Take care. You and all the horn staff rock. Nick. Thank you, Nick. And that just that is probably the cream of the crop of what came in. Most of the ninjas emailed me last night, and the support for what is something I normally wouldn't do but felt had to do, I appreciated it, and I thank you all for it. And the final word on this will be today's track of the day. And this comes from our one and only moderator in the chat room, not our only moderator, but the one, the only ELO, who sent me a track, and I think it's absolutely a brilliant choice, and I think it sums up everything about the whole giggle issue. And, oh, there I go again. And from the album Bathhouse Beauty from Bette Midler, and it's a track called Laughing Matters. And I just think this is a gorgeous song. It's a great lyric, and I think it just puts the perfect full stop on the subject. So without further ado, the one, the only, Miss Bette Midler with Laughing Matters. Hit it, Bob.
Live at 5 and CNN keep us all abreast of breaking stories that contend to make us anxious and depressed. Problems with no answers hang on like some chronic cough, and every day some brand new issue rears its head to piss you off. Bad guys win. Optimism's wearing thin. Things are spinning out of control. Cynicism's all the fad. World events could make us mad as hatters. Almost every day some underpinning slips away. These aren't laughing matters. Time bombs tick. People keep on getting sick. And a nickel's not worth the same. Wickedness and justice, peace is gaining ground. It shatters. Hate is here to stay, and justice goes to those who pay. Friend, these aren't laughing matters. The truth is scarier. The stories in the paper rise. The daily small decline and fall spelled out in black and white. Oh, what to do? What to do? How to take a brighter view when your noodle's totally fried. Human spirits need to be leavened by a little levity. So take those blues and
That is just absolute brilliance. Thank you, ELO. And I have no problem in saying that I think Bette Midler is one of the legends of music of all time. I think she's just phenomenal. I mean, that voice is to just absolutely die for. And some of the... she has an intonation that is so unbelievably unique. And you just can't miss that it's Bette. She's just awesome. I think that it's a gorgeous song. And I nominate that, Bob, there to go into the regular bumper list whenever it's deemed appropriate, because I just think that is just a wonderful song. Matters not style or volume. It just has to be good and sung from some sort of your soul, and that's just a brilliant piece of music. Thank you again, Sue. Love you for that. Geez, got to kind of get back into serious stuff. It's kind of like off in La La Land there for a minute. Brilliant. I love the strings and that beautiful comping guitar. Brilliant. Whoever did the arrangements on that. Seriously, that's just brilliance. Okay. We got this carbon trading thing to do, and I'm trying to decide whether I start with the case for or against. And I think... oh, pardon me. Actually, we'll put that off for a moment, because I am just noticed that we have David from Maine on the line, who I bumped off last night, so we'll go straight to David. Welcome to the program, David. How are you this evening?
No, John. You didn't bump me off. I was just going to say something briefly on that whole episode, since somebody who wanted attention on that. Real quickly, you know, that would be a good idea to have a BBC documentary on George Michael and Hitler. But seriously... because they
there
like
you go,
to,
you're making
you know,
me giggle again.
I know, they like to mix it up, but seriously, I just want to say something, and this is for a lot of other people. Seriously, when I can hear ice clink against the glass when you're calling people and you have an erratic mood shift with it, don't bother calling. Seriously. Let's be real about it, because if you seriously have a dark mood shift, my ears pick up on that, and I'm sure everybody's ears picked up on it, but we're being gentlemen and ladies about it. But you know, I think the best thing you can do is you cut the bridge off, and that person has to deal with whatever personal problems they're going through. And I just want to leave that and move on to something else, but you know,
happy to hear your opinion on the situation, and I do agree with you. And you know, last night's not something that I would normally do, but it came to a head.
Just to briefly comment on that, I mean, I was getting the feeling of this could be the sequel, Eric Bogosian's Talk Radio 2, except the sequel would be called Conversation Radio, but... to get on the subject of what laughter means to people, and I hope the person is still listening so he understands, I mean, if we didn't have laughter, do you have any idea how many riots would go through the entire America? Let's look at Richard Pryor. Even Steve Martin, who I was watching on Charlie Rose, there's a great hour interview with him. He was talking about what a worthless piece of crap he felt like in his life until he found music and comedy. He was tired of his job. He was tired of everything, you know? And one of the things he says, he just had that in his feeling, in his head, that he was worth nothing. But one of the amazing things about it is he said, I realized that I couldn't be the comedian that I saw everyone else be, so I transformed myself into something that I could be. And I think that's something that people need to understand. And I mean, also, laughter, for the people who have a problem with this, laughter releases carcinogens. And I don't know how many people are on their deathbed listening to this either. So, I mean, come on, people. there's something to be said for amplifying your positivity and amplifying whatever it is you have to say out in the open. And that's all I really have to say on that.
I appreciate that, because laughter is, you know, I mean, it's an old adage, but laughter is the best medicine. I mean, there is no doubt about it. And if it hadn't been for having what I think is a very healthy sense of humor, I think I would have gone absolutely nuts years ago.
Oh.
And it's only because I have the ability to laugh at myself first.
Right.
I mean, geez, I crack myself up all the time by my own lunacy. But it's that, you know, keeps me from losing my grip on reality. You know, there's been so many times, you know, one of the best things that can happen when you're like in a really, really dark moment,
right,
is to have some really, really funny film come on unexpectedly and you get lost in it and you have that belly laugh to the point where your stomach hurts and you have tears streaming down your face. But when it's over, you feel like a human being again. And you feel like you can stand back up to the world again, and
right,
you know, I love Steve Martin. He's one of my favorites, you know, from everything he's done. He's, you know, he's rated as one of the top 10 banjo players in the world.
Oh,
and
that's an amazing part on the Charlie Rose interview when he explains how he played banjo. Like when he played, I didn't know this. He started right when he got out of college.
Oh yeah,
it's amazing. He was really honest about it. He said he really sucked, and I cried a million tears, and I was like, wow, this is so real. And that's what people need to hear, instead of like, well, I just picked it up and da da da. No, and I mean, people should, like, you know, really, really express the point of where they were, because so many people, I mean, to me, so many people have this point where, you know, It's in the industry, it's entertainment, and it's everything, where it's a 0 to 60, and they really think it's like that. But and nobody talks really about, you know, like a really serious anecdote, you know.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if Steve mentioned this in the interview, but you know, he used his banjo early on in his comedy, and then when his career started to take off, there was a moment where he actually removed the banjo from his comedy, because he wanted to keep that for himself. And I remember a couple of years ago on Letterman's program, Steve Earle's bluegrass band, and I always forget the name of the band, but was performed on Letterman's show, and they did it very old school. No one plugged in, all around one big ribbon microphone. And Steve happened to be the other guest on that night, and he joined them. And to watch them interweave within one another to get, you know, when their little highlighting parts would come up so that they could step up towards the mic. And I mean, he's an unbelievably talented player. And it was amazing to watch. There's always people that have no clue about this aspect of the man. And to watch the camera go around to the audience as they're going, "That's Steve Martin?" And they just can't believe it, you know. They only remember him doing, you know, the excuse me bit with it.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I wanted to talk about, shifting gears, was I really think the music video of the month, it's really hit me because it's so visually arresting.
I still have to watch this. I got your email. I still haven't watched it.
Ice Cube video. Now, for those people who don't know, Ice Cube was like the most controversial rapper in the gangster rap era in the 90s. And whatever he was feeling at the time, like he had a song called Black Korea, which basically talked about what he was thinking, brutally honest in his mind about how the Koreans treated the blacks. And to do that at that time period was like, you are asking for it, Cube. But he honestly said, and then he said, but that's the way I was feeling, and that's how I felt. And he says, if there is some hatred there, I might have a problem with it, but I have to express myself. Anyways, A lot of flack has been taking on the whole tag of gangster rap. He has a video out and a song off his new album, Raw Footage, called Gangster Rap Made Me Do It. And basically, what the song is about is it starts out in a concept of, like, history revisionism. And they have these kids in this computer class, and their teacher goes, don't you remember that Compton was a country club? And he goes, but didn't Watts, wasn't Watts in violence and inner turmoil before gangster rap? And then this teacher, who looks really Orwellian, goes, wrong! It was a bunny preserve for rabbits! And then Cube just hits everyone hard, because people have been asking for Cube a long time to do this. There was a time where Ice Cube, he turned really like club-style Cube, where he didn't have the narrative and the message. But I guess what all the stuff that's been happening in the past 7 years, really, he focused and he put to pen what he was what was really on his mind. And it's amazing, because they have to have visions like this. I can't believe they're going to play this on MTV, but they probably will. He has visuals from the Carlisle Group to 9/11 to Iraq to the Watts in to the Watts riots to Martin Luther King to just everything, police beatings, and everything. After he says, he goes, I guess gangster rap made me do it. And he just says it right to the camera, and what it is he says, where do you think we learned it from? We learned it from you. He goes, I heard the word. He goes, I heard the N word back in 1971. Then you just see flashes of the images, just like giving it to him one after the other. I mean, the Bush administration, the Reagan administration, just every single visual, because I guess what's important in a four-minute video like this for people who aren't mentally aware, and to put something out like that, is to synthesize something, a message, so people understand the visuals and the interconnected timeline of what was going on. I mean, to just constantly pin it on someone is just so corrosive and so and so manipulative too.
Well, and you know, I always wonder how much of the bling bling kind of rap that's so manufactured by the labels these days is intended to overshadow the stuff like you're speaking of here. You know, one of my favorite rap albums is still Fear of a Black Planet.
Oh, and without a doubt.
You know, I mean, it's brilliant. It's just, it's one of the most pounding, intense pieces of work that has, I think, ever been done. But it was because I have always thought that because of the power of the narrative, like you said before, that is in so much of not just the so-called gangster stuff, but the really organic rap stuff, that the industry had to come up with this blingy, blingy, blingy thing. And now you have, and you know, the stuff that really makes me ill now is that a lot of these rap bands get paid commissions for how many times they mention expensive brand names in the songs. So, you know, you mention that you drive a Beamer.
Yeah.
You get money. You mention your De Beers diamond-encrusted whatsy-whosits. You end up getting stuff, and it you know, and I think it's all to detract from the organic form of the music that is actually trying to say something important, don't you reckon?
And you know, just one last thing on that before I close out, because I know you want to talk about carbon dating. Talking about Fear of a Black Planet and Chuck D and the parallels of what Flavor Flav is right now. Jamie Foxx was on the radio. He has a good radio show, and he talked about subjects called the Foxhole. And one of the subjects he brought up is he went to Japan, and he said, "We got off the plane. I had an entourage of my sister, my publicist, some of my friends, and we were in Japan and we noticed that we were the only black people there. Now, this is what's really revealing what he says. He had his hat tilted to the side. The instant he got off the plane, he heard a Japanese guy go, Flavor Flav! And he just went right up to him. And it's funny, but see, this is where I disagree with what Chuck D was saying. You're putting out that image. Flavor Flav does a reality show. You're putting that out image out to the world. This is the penalty you're going to be faced with. All of the black entertainers, all, it doesn't matter. Bishop Tutu could have gone over there if he was still alive. Anyone could have gone over there. They would have gone, Flavor Flav! Because you don't have that balance.
Hmm. And I didn't know anything about Flav doing some reality show. I just still remember...
Oh, yeah, he does this show called Flavor of Love. I guess that's what I... It's a love reality show, and he picks a...
Oh.
Yeah, I know. And Chuck D was saying, well, I like this because Flavor of Flav's a superstar, and I'm thinking. I guess the problem that people don't understand is that if you don't show that other side of Flavor, I hate to say it, but they're going to look at him like a minstrel icon, and you're going to put it across all the other countries, and anyone who has any kind of little bit of tilt to the hip hop culture or anything, or just say your hat's tilted the wrong way because you came off the plane, or you might look like Flavor Flav, or God forbid you have a clock around your neck. They're going to come up to you and they're going to act. They're going to act like that. They're not going to treat you like a human being or a citizen. They're going to treat you like a cartoon.
Yeah, and because all they know is this later cartoony version of your image, as opposed to what you did that ended up having them want to make money off of that image and then basically obliterate it from kind of what you're telling me. Because, you know, it was Public Enemy has always had my respect, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to completely judge Flava Flav on doing this because there's still this great catalog of wonderful narrative and timely written lyrics that I still think are just as powerful today as they were when they were first released. So, but you know, I totally understand, and it is too bad. And you know, Jamie Foxx, I can see him going, you know, Jesus, you know.
To put it in perspective for people who don't know Flavor Flav and Public Enemy, all of this, I'll put it in perspective real simple, and then I'll leave. My friend, she's from Texas. She wants to get into satellite radio. Okay, but here's the kicker, people. She's African-American. She's black. She's from the South, okay? Now, if you want to get into radio, here's where the fun begins, John. Here's where it goes. You ready?
Yeah.
You go to the urban department. They say, "Wow, you have the greatest voice. You're so together. You have a great resume. Are you ready for this?" Now, then they say, "But you're really too intelligent for our market. You gotta dumb it up."
That says volumes, mate. Volumes.
I know, and let me tell you something. There are so many black professionals. So many people in radio. So many people. I mean, this is a topic that nobody really talks about, but BET and VH1 and MTV, all these channels are partly responsible, even the Clear Channel, all the radios, because what they do is they turn the whole urban market into a morning zoo attitude. Like, we'll just talk about this and be stupid on the radio, or just be silly. Okay, maybe that's a better word for it. Just silly on the radio. And when you do that, that's what happened to BET, that's what happened to the radio market, and anyone who comes from an urban background or is African American or black, that's immediately what they're dealt with. And that's why you don't hear any of the voices that are like that, and you just hear Jesse Jackson on one of the obscure radio channels, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it minimalizes the real folks is what I think. And Clear Channel, you know, they'll they'll create a show in one city and pump it to, you know, 60 others and then do little voiceover spots going, New York City, we love you. And suddenly it's supposed to be local radio.
But before I go, John, I have to tell you, you got to watch Southland Tales. Because everything that we're seeing right now, I'm telling you, the visuals, I don't know if you've seen it yet, about the levitating ice cream truck.
No, I still have to see that.
You still haven't seen that. Well, when you see it, I'm telling you, all the visuals that are going right now, what Richard Kelly did and how he put this in there, it's just, it's one of the biggest trips when you watch it. But,
all right, man, I will make a point to see that. I have to. It's on that never-ending list that you seem to be always tacking stuff on for me.
Well, John, I just wanted to call because I hadn't talked to you in a while. And I waited like a bit of a period, and then, you know, kind of like time lapse. But the way I look at it, it's all nonlinear, so it doesn't really matter. Yesterday.
No worries, mate. And there's always a line for you. It's always great talking to you because you always bring something to the table that's interesting, and you got your finger on the pulse. So I appreciate it, man. I can't wait to talk to you the next time.
All right, man. You get into carbon dating now.
All right, man. Take care of yourself. And we're going to take a quick break. That was good old David from Maine. And we're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to come back and see how much of this carbon trading stuff I can get crammed into the last 25 minutes. You're listening to The Horn. We'll be back.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. While all attention was focused on the New Hampshire primaries, Bush was getting what he wanted in the Persian Gulf, a provocation, real or imagined, between the United States and Iran. Bush said that Iranian speedboats were chasing U.S. naval ships in the Straits of Hormuz, and the Pentagon supplied the footage. Iran denies it and says the footage was staged. Who's to know who's telling the truth on this one, especially in a week where the NSA admitted that there was no Vietnamese attack on the United States during the Gulf of Tonkin. That incident was all made up. This one might have been too, or it might have been real. Either way, it shows that Bush still has a twitchy finger when it comes to Iran. A lot of people thought that after the National Intelligence Estimate showed Iran had no nuclear weapons and no active nuclear weapons program, that the odds of Bush attacking Iran had gone way down. They haven't. He's just seizing on another excuse. Iran's actions, phantom or not, in the context of the Iraq War. As Bush himself warned, there will be serious consequences if they attack our ships, pure and simple. Bush is drooling at that possibility. He just loves being a war president. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Are you still looking for weapons of mass destruction? Concerned about the future of the Supreme Court? You want to know how government bureaucrats are changing Social Security, overtime pay, or the environment? Maybe you just want to know if the president's lying to you, or when our troops in Iraq can finally come home. I'm Mark Levine. I've got the inside scoop. When you want to know what's going on inside the Beltway, You need a Beltway insider. Someone who's worked in the government and still has sources willing to give you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. So for lively debate, reasoned opinion, detailed analysis of history and policy, or just a point of view you don't hear expressed in the mainstream media, tune in to the Inside Scoop. Feel free to call in too. Agree or disagree. All opinions are welcome. It just might make you think. That's the Inside Scoop, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 Central, 11 o'clock Pacific, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
The funk, baby. Nice one, Bob. Ah, yeah, gotta love that stuff. I could have let that all run all the way to the end. That's one of those songs that I just never know quite when to say go. Oh, damn, I'm giggling again. All right. Let's see how much... Oh, I hope that was like nails through someone's head. Anyway, let's get to some serious business here, people. Okay, we had the Bali Summit not all that long ago. And so things like carbon caps and trading schemes are, of course, going to be part of the discussion. And as I said before, Celsius.com has this great series of articles, and I'm really going to have to try and cram through this, and this might end up stretching on till Monday, because I think that this deserves some time. And so I'm going to do the articles in the order they were published. So the first one is the case against carbon trading. Now, carbon trading is the idea that businesses get so much carbon that they're allowed to produce, and they can buy carbon credits, which basically kind of comes up into ideas that you kind of pay someone else to be better so it compensates for your pollution. And there are trading schemes, and the carbon credits can be bought and sold and things like that. And so it's a very complicated issue, and the EU has been kind of having a test run of their system. So the first piece begins with an editor's note. It says, the Bali Summit has yet again put the world into somewhat of a but-wait mode. Life continues for most, with many hoping and trusting that politicians will work it out and bring solutions to the table in, say, 2 years or so. But while we wait, I think it's not a bad idea to really examine what exactly we're waiting for. While politicians seek to find some agreement on carbon trading, here at Celsius we're having an interesting discussion on the potential merits of such a scheme. Below is the latest in the discussion, and there's some links, for previous posts in the discourse. Input from our readers is welcomed. And this is from Kevin Smith from the Carbon Trade Watch. And he says here, one constantly hears the refrain, that we've learned our lessons and that the kinks have been ironed out with each successive experiment or round of emissions trading, and it just never seems to actually happen. How much longer can we give this untested and ineffectual experiment time to start working with such a small window of opportunity to mitigate the worst impacts of the threat of climate change. The precursor to phase one of the European Union emissions trading scheme, the EU ETS, was the UK emissions trading scheme, a pioneering trial phase of nationwide emissions trading that would give the companies an idea of how it would work in a larger EU-wide scheme. Here we see some of the obvious lessons learned that could have been applied to the EU ETS, but weren't. An investigation of the scheme of the Parliamentary National Audit Office reported that some companies' targets may be undemanding, and that in some key cases, emissions baselines were well above direct participants' emissions at the start of the scheme. Labour MP Jerry Steinberg described the scheme as a mockery and an outrageous waste of public money. Overgenerous baselines meant that four companies, Ines Flor, Invista, BP, and Rhodia, massively overcomplied in the first year. The fact that their emissions were already controlled under other environmental regulations led Edward Lay, the Conservative chair of the Public Accounts Committee, to observe that the scheme seems to be paying the four companies £11 million for keeping emissions down to levels they had already achieved before they joined. So basically, they're being paid to do nothing further. Then there's already been some mention of the disaster of phase one of the scheme. Under sustained corporate lobbying, almost all EU governments made huge over-allocations of permits to industry in the first place. In 2005, the first year of trading, the relevant industries across Europe emitted 66 million tons less than the cap that had been allocated. This meant that the cap was effectively meaningless, and it had not forced any net reductions. A preliminary analysis of the 2006 data shows that 93% of the 10,000 installations covered by the ETS emitted less than their allotted quota. In all, 30 million tons less than the total EU-wide allocation. Successful corporate lobbying also means that permits were allocated free of charge to industry in the first phase, but companies have been passing on the cost to consumers anyway. A study by UBS Investment Bank shows that the first round of the ETS had added 1.3 euro cents to each kilowatt hour of electricity sold. This sounds negligible until you consider that the German Minister for the Environment estimated that the four biggest power providers, E.ON, RWE, Vattenfall, and EnBW, had profited between 6 billion and 8 billion euros from passing on the imaginary cost of the first phase of the ETS onto consumers. So the view here, obviously, is that it's just giving another abusive kind of profit scheme for the biggest, and that the caps are putting no pressure as they stand right now. So how useful has this campaign been? A year ago, Citigroup's Peter Atherton confessed in a PowerPoint that the EU ETS had done nothing to curb emissions and acted as a highly regressive tax falling mostly on poor people. On whether policy goals were achieved, he admitted, prices up, emissions up, profits up, so not really. Who wins and loses? All generation-based utilities are winners. Coal and nuclear-based generators, biggest winners. Hedge fund and energy traders, even bigger winners. Losers, consumers. So, you know, and this piece goes on to basically say that the concept is not bad. It's the implementation and the constant kind of, it's a good idea, but just wait, we got to read and we got to research a little bit more, and nothing really concrete has come down that will force these outfits to actually cut down on their emissions. And yet, they turn around and add the cost onto consumers. So we, as the people of this world, lose on both ends. Now, I happen to think that a properly designed carbon cap and trading scheme could have benefit. But it's going to be tough, though. It has to bring real cuts. In other words, these companies need to actually have their goals be something that makes them cut their emissions. And if they go over, they then need to spend money in ways to try and at least compensate for their increased emissions. So, I mean, this is one of the most complicated issues in the global warming debate, hands down. This one really, really is just so all over the place and difficult to comprehend, because 30-second, 5-second, 10-second soundbite stuff does not give you any concept to what really goes on with these things and how they work. You'll only be able to get people say that, you know, it does work, it's brilliant, or it doesn't work, it sucks. And those that say it's brilliant are probably the ones that are making the profit. And unfortunately, this kind of scheme is the type of thing that will most likely be abused by the big polluters, in my mind. And so far, it has proven to be so. Now, like I said, because we're so pushed on time, but we're going to, I think we might do a couple more days on this subject. Because this is just huge. Now, the case four, I'll see how much of this I can get through. Starts out, it says, yesterday we published an interview with Kevin Smith on Carbon Trade Watch, and laid out their argument against carbon trading in all its forms, claiming that it has not been and cannot be an effective tool in the fight against global warming. Now, this author, whose name I can't find at the moment, says, I'm generally a proponent of carbon trading, and I have written about it on Celsius a number of times. As such, I thought I would continue the discussion by providing the case for carbon trading and responding to Smith and Kill. Let me first say, despite our disagreements on carbon trading, I hope we can recognize that we are on the same side. We agree that climate change is an epic crisis that needs to be addressed immediately with drastic action. Where we disagree, I believe, is on the most effective, efficient, and feasible means of tackling climate change. But in the end, we want the same outcome. So, kind of putting the thing out, you know, this is something we need to work through, not fight each other on. With that said, I'll start my response by summarizing the main points made by Smith and Kill. Please correct me if I've mischaracterized any of them. The EU ETS has been a failure and will continue as such. Carbon trading represents a privatization of Earth's carbon cycling capacity without a democratic process to determine where to give emissions rights. Tree planting is ineffective, potentially harmful means of reducing the planet's CO2. And there's an interesting argument here, because that it's a very feel-good thing to say, hey, you know, I bought a computer and they're going to plant a tree for me. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but it's not going to the heart of the actual issue, which is the emissions that we're putting out. And what happens if I go and, you know, spend whatever money on whatever and they plant a dozen trees for me in Victoria, Australia, and then the bushfires come. And the severity of the bushfires is being driven very much by climate change. So, it is a bit of an iffy thing. In a perfect world, which we know we don't live in, yeah, plant as many trees as you can. What we need to do is stop old forests, stop killing, you know, old forests. We need to cut back on the emissions, rah, 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 rah. And they also said the final point of the ante is carbon offsets reduce the need for our governments to give us a different set of choices, and a better solution would be an amalgam of action ranging from local movement to a national government investment program into appropriate technology. So they go on into, this author goes into their case for carbon trading, and they say, one, the EU ETS, Europe's carbon trading system under the Kyoto Protocol, has been a failure and will continue as such. The first part of the argument that the EU ETS has not achieved its goals so far is all but undeniable. Prices for carbon under the EU ETS dropped down to just a few cents and have never made a real recovery. Few countries have reached their emissions targets to date, and the biggest polluters have reaped windfall profits from the free allocation of emissions allowances. For anyone who has been involved in Kyoto, however, this has not come as a surprise, and not because they knew the EU ETS would fail, but because the first phase of the EU ETS, 2005 to 2007, was designed as a pilot phase, meant to work out the significant kinks in the system. Phase 2 of Kyoto just started last week, and it offers substantial differences from the pilot phase. The World Business Council for Sustainable Development released an article the same day as our interview was published, outlining many of these differences. Two of these struck me as most relevant. First, the primary reason for the EU ETS failure in Phase 1 was an over-allocation of permits by a number of countries. These countries acknowledged the mistake and attributed it to an admitted lack of complete information at the time regarding their own country's emissions. However, in Phase 2, new calculations are being used based on 2005 data, and the new assignments of permits should leave companies short around 250 to 260 million tons CO2 per year, requiring significant changes in environmental practice. Second, emissions targets in Phase 1 were voluntary. Phase 2 brings with it the introduction of mandatory emissions targets with international enforcement. Admittedly, this enforcement will likely extend only as far as public reprimand, but that has been an effective tool in other global environment agreements. Janet Peace, a senior economist at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, noted, "Many people miss the fact that Phase 1 was the learning phase, but the first part wasn't even Kyoto. That was their warm-up. This is how they figured out and got the infrastructure in place." So do I think it is fair to assume that the EU ETS has been effective so far? And I agree that providing windfall profits for the biggest polluters is a terrible idea, but it is not fair to write off the next stage, which has the potential to induce real lasting change. The Kyoto Protocol isn't nearly perfect, but it should be commended as a valiant attempt at global coordination against climate change. And I think that these are very, very good points. Shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, I think is what they're trying to say here. Number two, carbon trading presents a privatization of Earth's carbon capacity without a democratic process to determine where to give emissions rights. To some degree, this is true. Introducing mandatory carbon trading like a cap-and-trade system places the onus on private industry. It forces polluters to do something to reduce their impact on the planet's carbon emissions, whether it is changing their own practices or helping finance projects to do so elsewhere. It is important to note that, as Eric Carlson of CarbonFund.org said on National Public Radio last week, we need a 70% or so reduction in emissions. And in fact, that's all the planet actually cares about. It doesn't matter where emission reductions come from. 1 pound of CO2 in Bangladesh is 1 pound of CO2 in Poughkeepsie. So given the pressing nature of the crisis, we should be reducing our emissions in the places where we can reduce them the most, with least cost to our livelihood and the planet's biodiversity. This is the ultimate goal of carbon trading, to let the market determine the most effective ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I think efficiency has become something of a dirty word among activist circles, and often rightly so. Historically, the quest for efficiency has led to profit maximization at the expense of social justice, environmental maintenance, and economic equality. But in this case, it is a necessary consideration. If we do not reduce greenhouse emissions effectively, we will never avoid climate change-induced disaster. Government should certainly be involved, and indeed government has been the designer and controller of existing carbon markets, but markets should play a significant role as well. And there's a point, you know, there's a point here. We cannot have carbon being, you know, at pennies a ton. It needs to be $50, $60, $70, $80, $90 a ton for it to be truly effective and to truly and honestly put the pressure on these industries to make real change. Otherwise, they'll find ways to just make more profit and not actually make the changes that are needed. And I'm sorry that we're running out of time. I'm going to pick this up on Monday, because I think that this is just such a this is a crucial discussion. And in the meantime, if you have questions or you have any articles or interviews that you've come across on this issue that ring true or bring something to the debate, please email them to me, JON@headonradionetwork.com. I would like to get as much as possible about this. And I think maybe this, now that I think about it, this probably deserves a few days, because this is probably one of the most complicated subjects that fall under the issue of, you know, saving this planet and global warming. So, you know, it's just a crucial debate that needs to be had, and we need to hack this stuff out, you know. And truly, even though the EU thing is an experiment on its own, the only way that it's ever going to work is that everyone has to be involved, and that means the United States stepping up to the table. Australia signed on to Kyoto. We're going to have, you know, we're in this please wait thing. So while we're please waiting, we need to add to the debate. We need to have the discussion. We need to have the conversation on how we make this kind of a system actually work for benefit, and look at both sides of the argument. You know, this is not something where you, this is not a subject where I believe you can have any kind of fundamentalism. This is something that we've never done before. So we need to really think about what we're doing. But while we're thinking about it, we need to take serious action and constantly develop the policy until we find a system that brings on the changes we need. So with that, I think we're going to wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, for such a great week. Thanks to Bob for producing. Thanks to Agnes for popping up last night. Thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society for the streaming and the archives, Scott Berry at B1 Ladder Productions, and, of course, our wonderful sponsors, Coal River Mountain Watch, whose little banners you should be seeing on the Horn site now, and their wonderful work. And I cannot wait to see that film from Patchwork Films. So, as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you on Monday.
If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I would tell you that sometimes it's easier to desire and pursue the attention and admiration of 100 strangers than it is to accept the love and loyalty of those closest to me. And I would tell you that sometimes I prefer to look at myself through someone else's eyes, eyes that aren't clouded with the tears of knowing what an asshole I can be, as yours are. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I might be able to listen in silence to your concerns, rather than hearing everything as an accusation or an indictment against me. I would tell you that sometimes I use sex to avoid communication. It's the best escape when we're down on our luck. But I can express more emotions than laughter, anger, and let's f***. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, if ever I would stop thinking about music and politics.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good morning, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop, part of the Dialogue series on WPFW. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I used to work as an attorney for the Democrats in Congress on the House Judiciary Committee and House Homeland Security Committee, and now I'm on the air giving you the inside scoop. And it may surprise you that as much of an activist as I am, as much